And as I go, I love to sing my knapsack on my back.
Good morning and welcome to Wanderings. This is Syl Stenman.
This is Sandy Washington.
And we welcome Jim Neal today, who's got so much to say. But Jim, I have a question for you. Where were you on January 27th, 1967?
Most of the day on that day, I spent in the launch control room for the Apollo Saturn 204 launch. It was the Apollo 1 mission with astronauts Grissom, Chaffee, and White. I left the control room at the end of my shift at 4 p.m., and a few minutes later, all three of those gentlemen were dead.
That is just such a sad story. But it happened because of what?
It primarily happened because of the atmosphere they were breathing was pure oxygen, which was the standard at the time. And unfortunately, there was a frayed wire in the spacecraft that caused a spark and an ignition, and a tremendous fire ensued that
quickly, with a spark?
With a single spark from a frayed wire. We tested all switches, everything else, but the one thing that missed somehow was a scraped wire somewhere in the fabrication of the spacecraft.
And that fire caused the explosion?
It was, I have seen the film many times, including right after the fire, but it's instantaneous, and so the deaths were very, very quick.
Well, on a smaller scale, you can imagine when there's a sign on the door say, no smoking, oxygen in use. It's not the same oxygen, but that's a warning, isn't it?
It's a tremendous warning because it's a bad situation. And after that, the entire usage of the pure atmosphere, oxygen atmosphere in chambers of all kinds, as well as spacecraft, changed to a mixture that was less flammable.
So there was a lot of going back and figuring out, how are we going to avoid this? How can we stop it?
The spacecraft was available. That happened, I believe it was I think it was a Friday afternoon. The tests would have run all night long and finished up on Saturday. But the spacecraft was pulled down after it cooled and inspected thoroughly, and those of us that were able to be close and look it over got ideas of what happened and how rapid and how bad it was. So from that, all kinds of studies and looking at components, and until they determined, dissected essentially the spacecraft to find out where the source of the ignition was. We were looking at all the components within the spacecraft, all the components leading up to it, and so forth.
So yes. You were probably hours on that search.
Days. Months.
Oh, goodness.
And this explosion took place on the launch pad.
It was on launch pad 34, and the spacecraft itself was up at the 200-plus foot level, 205 feet or so.
So high up there.
Yeah. The escape tower rocket on top of the spacecraft was at 230 feet. So take off 8 feet, you've got the 220 feet plus in the air.
I'd have to see it to believe it. It's really hard.
And there was another explosion at the same time, wasn't there?
Very closely in time to that, a Navy chamber experienced a fire where, I can't recall the details of all of it, but 6 or 7 men were killed in that fire. They were breathing a pure oxygen atmosphere as well.
They were Navy men?
I believe all of them were Navy personnel.
And their death was instantaneous.
I assume it was. It was a larger chamber, but still, with the atmosphere, it would have been certainly very quick.
Breathe it right in.
Yes. Yeah.
How is it that you began this career?
I have a lot connection with Redstone Arsenal and Dr. Werner von Braun's operations, as my first cousin was his private secretary for about 20 years, and I used to visit his office on the weekends when he wasn't there, although I have met him, did meet him at the during that period. Plus, I had a cousin that worked there and was in the launch business on previous versions of rockets back in the late 50s, in the early development of launches out of White Sands. So it became natural. My mother worked on that Redstone Arsenal building artillery shells during World War II. So, and I was born across the river from the arsenal, so it was kind of...
You knew about it at an early age.
I knew about it all my life,
all
yes.
All your life, wow.
And you're an electrical engineer.
My degree is in electrical engineering, correct.
And yes. You got that where? Is it...
Auburn University, which is East Alabama, near the Georgia state line.
And then how did it progress that you got into the work right away?
As soon as I graduated, I went to work for the Chrysler Corporation, which was responsible for launching the first Saturn 1Bs with the Apollo spacecraft on top. The Saturn V wasn't finished with development and was going to be too late to do the early testing, so they chose to do the Saturn 1B, which was a heavy enough launch vehicle to get it into orbit.
Now, I recall from talking to you yesterday something about a grocery store. What was made in the grocery store?
Grocery store? Oh, you mean the related to the space industry?
Yes.
Well, a grocery store on South Federal here in at about 2800 South Federal was converted to a small factory by the Martin Marietta Corporation, and they won the bid to build the all the launch control equipment for the space shuttle. And we developed that equipment, tested it, delivered it to the Cape and to Houston. We shipped out over, I believe, around 120 truckloads of computers and electronic equipment out of the small family grocery store.
It's just incredible. But great things do start small sometimes.
Yes.
They really do. You were at Cape Canaveral for how long?
I was at Cape Canaveral for about 2 years before the Chrysler part of the Apollo program was winding down. And I didn't particularly want to go to work for Boeing, who had the Saturn V launches. So I took a job in St. Louis with a company called Emerson Electric, who was doing defense work. We were checking out and repairing avionics for the war effort, at that time, Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. You worked on something called... The name I can recall from our conversation was a parasol.
Oh, the parasol was an emergency operation for the Skylab space vehicle that we placed in orbit. And once it arrived, the main part of the spacecraft that carried the solar panels failed to deploy all of them, and so there wasn't enough electrical power to cool the keep the spacecraft from overheating, make it too hot to be inhabited for any period of time. Inside, you would have had to been in a spacesuit and protected. So the emergency operation was to develop a parasol that could be installed in space by a couple of astronauts to shield the spacecraft from the sun in order to keep it cool and make up for the loss of electrical cooling.
Well, just now I'm trying to visualize it. What was it made out of? What was it and how big was it? It had to be huge.
Well, it's almost a... It was part of the Mylar, is the modern product that it was most similar to. It was a very thin Mylar-like compound.
We would know that from the balloons.
The balloons, yes. Mm-hmm. Similar. Very similar. It had a woven coating to give it a little more stability, plus a highly reflective surface.
And where was it attached, or how?
It was attached primarily over the the laboratory section, which is where the men lived and worked mostly, where all the earth resources, experiments, and that sort of thing were being carried out.
There is so much involved. When I think about the wires that you had to inject within everything and then the outer part, it's just beyond me.
Well, that small can, which was roughly a little over 10 feet in diameter and maybe 30 feet long, I spent almost 2 years inside a significant portion of my life inside that vehicle on the test floor out at Waterton campus of Martin Marietta, yes.
Well, you referred to the can. What, out of the can, what exactly is that?
It was the metal surrounding that held all the instruments, held the men. It was the living quarters and the
Everything. Working
quarters for it.
Big.
For the Skylab, yes.
Well, you've been amazed through all these different launches. Tell us about the two people that are going to come back in February.
I feel sorry for their families, and I feel sorry for them, because what they signed up for was like a 2 or 3 day mission.
When actually did that start? How long ago has it been? Do you remember?
It was, I believe, earlier in the summer. They've been up for several months already now. My problem was that is that in the old days, and I'm old enough to talk about that now, safety was paramount, and it would have been inconceivable to put people in Earth orbit with no way of getting back without some backup. Like on the space shuttle, or the you have backup systems to go up and retrieve people. I think it was a tremendous mistake and decision on part of NASA management that allowed that to happen. I understand the rush for the moon, which is what they were primarily engaged in, was an early test of their spacecraft. That spacecraft had problems on Earth with leaking gas and the launch was postponed at maybe as many as 2 times before they got off, and it was still experiencing a leak of gases the day they launched, according to the information I've had.
Mm-hmm.
So when it got there and had further problems that said it's unsafe for return to Earth.
Wasn't there a rescue mission?
The rescue mission will be in January or February of next year.
Wow.
They've got a few more months to go.
You mentioned something about beach parties. And tell us about the astronauts, a little bit of something on a lighter
beach,
side.
Cocoa Beach and Cape Canaveral were slightly wild and crazy in the heyday of the space race. There were a lot of young guys, young engineers, a lot of young ladies working on the projects. So every launch necessitated a beach party to celebrate whether it was successful or not. So people would always get together after a launch to have a beach party. And if we didn't have a launch, we'd get together and have a beach party anyway. But that's where I met my wife, Patricia,
pre-launch.
At a beach party on Cocoa Beach.
Was she working there? Was she on vacation? What did she...
Patricia went to school in Florida and took a job teaching.
That's her place of birth, wasn't it?
She was teaching on Merritt Island, which is very close, but living, of course, where everybody wanted to live, right on the beach at Cocoa Beach.
But we want to hear more about her career, too.
Well, Pat was always in education, wasn't she?
Except when we moved to Denver, she couldn't get a job right away. And she took a job and got a real estate sales degree. And that didn't work out very well. So the first time a job opening came up in Cherry Creek, she jumped on it and stayed with them for around 30 years or so. And then moved to Douglas County as a principal. But
well, I've always felt that education is the best career there is.
Well, it worked out well for her and for me.
To advance to being a principal is no small task. I think she's done marvelously to be able to do that.
Yes.
So she's just, what did she start, what level, with a elementary or high school?
She had a primary school as principal with 750 kids in a year-round situation, kindergarten through third grade, 750 kids. And while she was there, she started, along with some members in the community, a preschool that operated in conjunction with the school.
Well, that was a lot of foresight because we're using more and more of those while mothers are being employed. And
she's a media specialist also, isn't she?
She had a degree in media, was her first master's. Her second one, I think, was in one of the fields in special ed and learning disabilities, and then library science.
Well, then no wonder she was qualified for a principalship because she knew all those.
She went ahead and got her certification for the principalship as well.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
That's wonderful.
So in back to the space just a brief question. Were there a lot of women? You said a lot of women were at these beach parties. What kind of jobs were the women doing that were involved in the space program?
Well, I never knew a female engineer during that period of time within Chrysler or NASA that I met. Most of the young women were in secretarial, or a lot of experienced women were in actually doing wiring work, which what we called wireline, where a lot of the fabrication of the cables, equipment happened that went into either a spacecraft or the launch support equipment. So there were probably more ladies in the delicate work field back then than, and it's still a lot of truth in that today. The wire lines and most of the factories are still staffed by our ladies.
Now, during a launch, we see on TV all these TV sets. You have more technical terminology than I. They're all looking at something, and something happens. And I see a lot of women. Yay, this is wonderful. What are they all looking at the same thing, or what?
No.
Okay, tell us about that.
Typically, every screen will have a specific area that they're monitoring. It may be the pressures in a cell, a particular tank, electric. That's developing electricity to support spacecraft or whatever. Or it may be pyrotechnics on board the spacecraft, their systems being monitored. Those are all primarily individual tasks. And in the background, there are other guys that are switching back and forth that are watching the watchers to make sure that nothing escapes anybody. So,
a lot of cameras on board there. On the spacecraft?
Yes, there are cameras on board. And I got to admit, I was involved in the first camera ever to go in space.
You were?
I was. It was on our early Apollo launch, and everybody's seen the film where a ring falls away from the rocket, and you're looking at a film, a TV, a radio TV picture of that falling away ring, which was the instrument ring. But yes, one of my buddies and I were responsible for that installation and the cabling and the checkout and monitoring of that.
So I think we could keep you
I see a little bit of history of my history every time I see that film. So yeah.
Well, you're a photographer also. Isn't photography one of your hobbies?
I started out taking lots of film pictures and slides. I scanned about 48,000 of them, and I got tired, and I'm taking a hiatus right now from finishing that job. But like always, the pictures you kept are not worth keeping, so I'm down to about 18,000 keepers at the moment.
Unless they're people in the pictures.
Unless they were significant reasons from family portraits or something that, even though they might not be of the best quality, they're worth keeping, yes.
But that's how you learned about Colorado. Tell us how you came to Colorado.
One of our best friends from St. Louis and his wife, they were both our good friends from our early days, came to Colorado for a visit. They came back and had a slideshow and a dinner a couple of weeks after they got back, and Pat and I looked at each other and said, we need to go there. So that was an autumn trip, so they had beautiful fall scenery, as I recall. So the next spring, on Memorial Day, Pat and I flew to Denver on Friday night, and spent 3 days or 2 days in Denver, going to the museums and up on Mount Evans and as high as we could get on Memorial Day, which was up to Summit Lake, as I believe. And then we picked up a camper and did a circumnavigation of the western slope from Craig and I-70 corridor and Grand Junction, Grand Mesa, and back in the southern route over Wolf Creek Pass and back to Denver. So we moved and we got back to St. Louis and said, we've got to go. And 3 months later, we moved to Denver.
Yeah. And you moved to Summit County. Such a beautiful area.
Yes, we were fortunate enough to have a weekend place to escape to over the several years. And when we retired, we did build a home in Summit County and moved up there for a while. But as you get older, those winters get colder, and the snow gets heavier to move. So I appreciated the guys when they started shoveling this week.
Did you get up there on weekends? Or
we were up on weekends for about 25 years, and then we moved up full-time for a few years until the winters got too hard.
You and Pat are both skiers.
We were both skiers. We were both snowshoed. We both cross-country skied. We both hiked and backpacked. So
and even after you retired, you found a way to ski economically.
I did work at Copper Mountain for $8.50 an hour for a period of time. It was cheap skiing. I could go work for 4 or 5 hours in the morning and ski in the afternoon. And not have to fight weekend crowds
to ski.
It's not very cheap now.
No, you could you could ski late in the afternoon after the Denver crowd had already left the mountain, so it was great.
I know someone that's going to be upset at me if we don't ask about your dogs. I've met them once, but I know that they're important part of your household.
They're beautiful.
Important. They rule the house.
They rule.
We have two dogs, the West Highland White Terrier. His name is Gilly, and it's spelled with the Scottish spelling with a L-L-I-E on the end. It's a Gaelic word that basically stands for guide. It's been a term used by the landowners and other people for the groundsman who keeps looks after the place and makes sure the game is healthy for the rich people to come and do their hunting. So he's my guide after that. The other dog is a Scottish Terrier. Her name is Miss Piper of Barra, and Barra is an island in the Hebrides, a small island, and it's the home place of the McNeil clan, of which I have some long past association.
So. They have their own plaid and their own this and that, all these clans, don't they?
Yes.
Do you and Pat do the walking? Do you have a system when you go out, when Pat goes out?
Pat's an early riser. She likes to go out first thing in the morning. So I get the late shift. Like this morning, she walked them early, went off to her exercise class, and I walked them for the longer walk.
Well, I hope she's listening to you today.
No, I think she's off doing something else.
Really?
She never slows down.
Well, I know
she
I could
listen to the encore.
Yeah, that's going to be on Friday. You can tune into that.
Okay.
Same time on Friday. But I wish we could keep you longer because there's so many questions. But what a fantastic career, and how thankful we are that you've been on that job. And it's a big responsibility, and you know what you're doing. And we honor you for that.
I used to. Somehow the skills go away over time.
You retired at what year?
I retired in 1999 on my wedding anniversary.
Oh. So. Well, Jim, thank you so much for being with us on Wanderings today. And anybody that wants to know more, go to the library, look in the, Sandy, what's the name of the book?
New Kids on the Block.
And your story. There's more in the story. Everybody that comes in does a bio for
the last year.
That notebook in the last year. So there's more to know. And thank you again.
Thanks, Sil.
That's Wanderings for today.